This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest stories in the Chicago area. But first, it's been nearly 5 years since Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a bill into law, making Illinois the first state to require public schools to teach Asian American history. The goal of the TEACH Act was to bring visibility to Asian American experiences and help curb a rise in anti-Asian hate. 5 years later, advocates say we are making progress. So how exactly are things going? In this episode of the pod, we'll hear from educators who helped build the new Asian American history curriculum and who trained their peers on how to teach the content. They'll give us a status report and discuss the gaps that still remain. At the table was Grace Pai, Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, Smita Garg, who's an education consultant and former volunteer of the TEACH Curriculum Development Team, and Laura Oak, who's the Dean of College and Career Counseling at Noble Schools. 5 years in, I wondered what our guests had been reflecting on. So I asked, how are you feeling at this moment? Smita went first.
What I'm seeing is a positive ripple effect, and I really appreciate that. I think I have a lot of empathy for teachers and having a lot on their plates, and it can be overwhelming to have new mandates come through. Part of our goal was to ease that with the TEACH Act coming through and offer them the tools to authentically weave in Asian American history into what they're already doing.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing evidence of that in different spaces. You know, I'm seeing book titles on shelves with characters from diverse backgrounds, of AANHPI backgrounds. I'm seeing the Field Museum put out trainings that are excellent to, again, empower teachers to bring the content forward. I'm seeing recipients of the training, like WITS, working in the schools, a literacy organization that works with the public schools, have titles, you know, again, coming to students with characters from these backgrounds.
That's that progress I just alluded to.
It's
That's
a lot
great.
Of progress. So it's wonderful to see, and it's very heartening to see things move forward. And in schools, you'll hear from Abby Castillo as well speak to what she's bringing.
We'll dig more into all of this. But Grace, tell me your reflections right now, 5 years in.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to believe that it's already been 5 years.
We've talked quite a few times over the years as you were working to get this through, push this legislation through.
And it was a years-long process to even get the legislation passed. So now that we're, you know, 5 years into implementation, I'm feeling hopeful. You know, it's legislation is always a starting point, and implementation is the real challenge. Certainly, there have been challenges in implementing the TEACH Act, just like with any curricular mandate. But, you know, students are advocating for themselves. They're asking their teachers or their administrators, hey, what's the plan for implementing the TEACH Act? And that, I think, is really
that's great.
Exciting.
Yeah. Laura.
Yeah, just going off of what Grace mentioned, like I've had the fortune of being able to still facilitate trainings across our country, including educators in Illinois. And I know the trainings feel really different now, but in a good way. There's more openness and curiosity from educators. People want to do this well. They just don't always know where to start. And so it's been great to still continue the momentum of providing these resources across different organizations, across different resources, and showing them that that isn't really something extra squeeze in, but something more so that can be integrated into what they're already teaching. So that has been really, you know, heartwarming to see, as well as also encouraging to continue doing that work in different scopes.
And Laura, so we're clear. I mean, what did Asian American history education look like in Illinois schools before the TEACH Act in 2021?
I mean, honestly, it was pretty minimal. It showed up, but usually in very limited ways. Usually there was a quick mention of immigration or maybe Japanese American incarceration, if that, but not much more beyond that. So there wasn't really any consistency across schools. And a lot of that really depended on whether a teacher went out of their way to include it. So for many students, especially Asian American students, they just didn't really see themselves reflected in what they were learning.
Yeah. And you know, the Illinois House Democrats passed legislation earlier this month, too. I wanted to mention this requires Latin American history be taught in schools. So that's going to the Senate at this point. But again, progress all around.
That's part of the ripple effect that Smita talked about. It's not just about what's happening in classrooms, but also what legislators are considering in terms of how can we make the teaching of American history truly inclusive. Mm-hmm. It's not just about Asian Americans. It's not just about Latin Americans, right? We have to think about the full diversity of our Illinois community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And teaching a more complete history with diverse perspectives. I'm reminded of an educator who asked that question. How do we give more examples of solidarity? Mm-hmm. How do we bring this forward to our teachers, you know, into classrooms?
Yeah. And Grace, you know, the TEACH Act was passed a year after the start of the pandemic. Remember those times, right? It was tough.
Yes.
We saw rising rates of anti-Asian hate and violence. I think that was sort of the reason for you sort of coming on the program back then to talk about what that's looked like here in Chicago, here in Illinois. So tell us more about the timing here of making sure that a curriculum like this was implemented in classrooms.
Right. I mean, it was in some ways really coincidental because we had launched the effort to pass the TEACH Act before COVID hit, before the rise in anti-Asian racism, before the Atlanta Spa shootings. But it became even more important once all of those things came to be. You know, we saw the need for addressing the root causes of anti-Asian racism, and education was such a perfect place to start, you know, with young people. We saw so many elders and, you know, seniors in the Asian American community being targeted with violence, but young people is really where we can make that difference. So that was, you know, really helpful, honestly, context and within which to push for this bill because it created a lot more political will. You know, as unfortunate as it is to have to point to rising racism and, you know, harassment and violence, that did generate a lot more momentum for us to get something done when it comes to Asian American history.
Right.
Legislators could understand why it was important.
Mm-hmm. Smita, I want to dig into the actual curriculum. What does it take to create an Asian American history curriculum for Illinois classrooms? What did you include? Where did you start?
That's an excellent question. I think it was a little difficult initially to start and important to acknowledge a difference between Asian and Asian American history. That was an important distinction that we needed to make as educators when we were teaming up in the beginning. And when I say it was difficult, it was because many of us didn't receive this content ourselves. I grew up with a Midwest education too, you know, and so it was a little tricky in that mm-hmm. regard. But we came together. I think it was really helpful to have those who had some background, those of us who had a skill set in understanding what needed to be taught in classrooms and merging those things together, and a whole lot of research, a lot of hours, a lot of time, coming together. But so delineating, you know, that we were talking about East Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and we dipped into the Pacific Island, you know, and that was something that we conveyed in the teacher trainings later that I was hired on for, right?
Yes.
You know, I think it was important to acknowledge, well, who are we talking about? You know, let's start there, you know, and when are we talking about this? I asked educators to anchor in their minds the timeline of late 1800s onwards. And I think that came as a surprise to many, myself included early on, to be completely forthcoming. So I think it was important to give ourselves grace as educators coming forward. And I say that still to educators bringing the content to their classrooms now.
Right.
And it's really important when you say a curriculum, I think there's value in emphasizing that we are weaving in content into existing classrooms, you know, into existing curriculum. So for teachers to understand, you can do this.
Yes.
You can do this with your lessons that already exist.
Well, Laura, I mean, you are one of the ones still doing this today as far as, you know, working to educate our educators around Asian American history. Talk about the current training that you're doing for teachers.
Yes. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, it's like, it feels like very different now as time has gone on and more people are like, you know, picking up bits and pieces of information of our community, you know, both in the educational space, but also in just the mainstream space as well. And so like, I think like, I love being able to now see that there is more openness and more curiosity from educators. And like, just like Smita mentioned, like, you know, being able to differentiate between the different, you know, like groups within our community has been like really like heartwarming going to see people being able to like want to learn more specifically and like knowing more like within Illinois, like what are the, you know, like top groups that we see that identify as Asian American Pacific mm-hmm. Islander, and wanting to learn specifically more about how to teach, you know, to those groups and about those groups. And so yeah. I think a lot of it's just like, you know, seeing that the work is, you know, doable. And then like, there's like this click of all of a sudden like, oh, ha, like it actually, you know, this does belong here. And like, it is very important for students to learn like Asian American identifying or not.
Yes. Yes. We're talking about a group that is not a monolith, right? We say that all the time.
Exactly.
And Grace, you told our producer that the way that history is taught is just as important as the content itself. Say more on that.
Absolutely. In our teacher training workshops, we really focused on how educators approach teaching Asian American history. You know, both what Smita said of weaving it into existing curriculum. We don't want there to just be 2 days focused on Asian American history and they check a box and that's it, right? Really, Asian American history is part of all of the teaching of U.S. history. There are opportunities to bring in Asian American stories when they are not being talked about otherwise. Like, for example, when talking about the farm worker movement, the labor movement, talk about Larry Itliong and the Filipino farm workers who were part of that, mm-hmm. not just, you know, the Mexican-American farm workers who were leading that movement. So, you know, I think there are some of these overlooked stories that we tried to highlight, but also we wanted to really help educators become more aware of the dominant narratives and stereotypes about Asian Americans that may kind of permeate how they teach about Asian American stories. And so we really wanted to equip teachers with just some more awareness of how to approach it thoughtfully, how to really teach about Asian American history in a culturally sensitive and responsive way.
Now, we also heard from an educator, Abby Castillo, from Skinner North. That's a CPS elementary school in Old Town. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say about all this.
When I explain the TEACH Act to my students, they are typically shocked that this is such a new requirement. I like to ask the question, who's missing, when we are reading about a historical event, and this has prompted some powerful conversations about who is telling the story and who has been left out and why.
So Abby goes on to say much more. She says, you know, teaching history without AAPI contributions and perspectives, it's providing only part of the picture, and we can't call it history if we're leaving out important parts, and AAPI stories are a hugely important part of the history. What do you think, Smita?
I agree. And Abby did a wonderful job at Skinner North with this implementation. She's really hit the ground running.
A school with, I hear, what, a 50% Asian population?
Mm-hmm. So when we hear that, we think about, windows, mirrors, and sliding glass doors. I'm going to throw out that metaphor. It's actually Radeem Sims Bishop out of Ohio State. I'm an Ohioan, so shout out for that. But we talk about offering students mirrors that reflect their own lived experiences, windows that give them a glimpse into others' lived experiences, and sliding glass doors to be able to walk through and really have that empathetic, you know, have built empathy when learning about different histories. So I think there's such value in this. I absolutely agree with Abby.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add about, you know, the importance of not leaving out these parts of history?
I think so many Asian Americans have experienced this feeling of being invisible. And so it's really important that we go that extra mile to address, you know, some of these past experiences and to really show students that their experiences are valued no matter what identities they hold.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the dominants? I talked about the anti-Asian hate of, you know, especially of 2020, 2021. Talk to me about some of the dominant and harmful narratives of Asian Americans that you want educators to be aware of so they don't, as they're teaching, continue to perpetuate some of these stereotypes.
Right. The two that we highlight in our workshop, the first is the perpetual foreigner myth, which is this idea that Asian Americans are not from here, that they're from somewhere else, right? Oftentimes we saw harassment during COVID, you know, look like things like people saying, hey, go back to the country you came from, or you're not welcome here. And that is a very pervasive experience and something that a lot of Asian Americans have gone through personally, right? Somebody who asks or who tells them, you know, you don't belong here, go back to your country. In fact, my dad experienced that, you know, mm-hmm. when I was a kid growing up in front of me. And so that is coming from a place of Asian Americans always being treated as this threat or an outsider. And we want to make sure that when people are teaching about Asian Americans, that we're not talking about Asian Americans as an other. The other myth that is very pervasive also is the model minority myth. This idea that Asian Americans are quote unquote the good minority, that we're high achieving, highly educated, all of that. And what I think is important for educators to know is that that is manufactured. That mm-hmm. idea is manufactured. And it comes from the U.S.'s history of immigration law. We only allowed in Asian Americans who were, you know, quote unquote, high achieving or highly educated. We recruited them for specific, you know, labor needs or specific employment needs. And so, you know, that there's a reason why the Asian American community looks that way in the United States, and it's a direct result of racist immigration policy.
Yeah. And that has changed over time, too. We now have, you know, immigration policies have changed over time, and there's been an opening up. So it's important when you think about that in the classroom, when there is an Asian American student raising their hand, they still need help. They still need support. Let's not assume certain things about them. And likewise with community service resources with dollars being funding offered for funding in mm-hmm. different communities, they're still needed, you know? And so I just piggybacking on that, I think it's important to dismantle those stereotypes
as well.
That is a
great point. Laura, take us to the classroom right now. Let's learn a little bit more history. What is an example of an Asian American story that has often been overlooked in our textbooks and in our classrooms? I know Grace talked a little bit about Larry Itliong a moment ago from the mm-hmm. Farm Workers Union. Tell me some more.
Yeah. Another story that I like to share with new educators during like the different like teacher trainings, as well as also in interacting with students, is Teresa Lee, a Chicagoan. She came to the U.S. from South Korea as a child, from Brazil originally, and then grew up undocumented. And I think a lot of folks don't realize that the status being undocumented also impacts Asian American Pacific Islander communities. Mm-hmm. And so as a teenager, she realized that there were just so many young people like her and started speaking out about it. And so something too that we, you know, have tried to highlight over the years is that, you know, Asian Americans didn't just simply exist, you know, in America. We've also advocated for ourselves and advocated for others. And so, you know, she was so young, but she didn't just wait. She, you know, used her own story to push for change. And that is why we have the DREAM Act today.
Yeah.
I think the youth are the ones, like Grace said, who are really coming forward. I have
Tell me more about what you're hearing from the students.
Well, I'll refer to my own child. We're at middle school and elementary, and International Day was wrapping up last year. We're leaving the India table. And he said, "Mom, next year, can we do the America table?" And I must have paused. as he's wearing his, you know, Indian outfit, myself as well, and he's never actually been to India yet. That's a goal. But I paused and he's like, "Well, Mom, you teach Asian American history. You've been doing this for years. You know, what about the American side?" And I said, "Yes, let's do it."
Ah.
And that's what we're doing next week. And it's important. It brought me back to reflect, you know what, if we're not seeing ourselves as American, how can we expect anyone else to see us that way?
Mm.
And that goes back to bringing in the content into the classroom, the history, you know, the cultural identity, the opportunities to consider cultural identity and reflect on our own and see others' experiences as well.
Yeah, I love that story. Let's go around the table before we wrap. Tell me your hopes for the future of Asian American studies and stories in education and any gaps that you still see. Grace, you want to go first?
Sure, I'll start with the gaps and end with the hope. I think the gaps are that it is very challenging to implement a curricular mandate across Illinois' more than 850 school districts, right? So there is certainly room for improvement. And while we've trained almost 3,000 teachers, there are many thousands more. But, you know, what gives me hope really is seeing students advocate for themselves, young people really taking accountability into their own hands and advocating not just around Asian American history, but around anything that they want to see changed in their schools or in their classrooms.
Yeah. Laura, what's giving you hope?
I think my biggest hope is that this work doesn't feel new anymore as time goes on, that it just becomes a normal, expected part of how we teach U.S. history. And I hope that we get to the point where students aren't waiting until high school or even college to see themselves reflected in what they're learning. And so for educators, I hope there's that continued support and investment, that this isn't just like a one-time or two-day training or initiative, but something that's sustaining and evolving. And then just being able to, you know, have students see themselves reflected. There's always just that like light and, you know, and joy in their eyes that I just continue. I hope that we continue to have that deeper understanding across communities.
Nice. Smita, last word to you.
Sure. I think we're living in a time where we are truly valuing the sense of belonging, you know, communities coming together. And so I do also have hope. The eternal optimist in me believes that you know, teachers will be supportive of this effort. And I appreciate people like you bringing it, the message forward too. So thank you for
that. The least we can do.
That positive ripple effect.
Smita Garg is an education consultant and former volunteer of the Teach Curriculum Development Team. Grace Pye is Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. And Laura Oak is the Dean of College and Career Counseling at Noble Schools. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
For a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. At the table to help me break them down was Lisa Labas, WBEZ anchor, Sophie Hernandez-Simeonidis, WBEZ digital producer with the Arts Desk, and Mitchell Armentrout, a Sun-Times politics reporter. There's been an update on the status of one of the officers who was shot last weekend at Swedish Hospital. Lisa filled us in.
Sasha, it's sounding a little more positive. So yesterday, the reports were that this officer who was wounded, his partner, John Bartholomew, was killed on Saturday at Swedish Hospital. We're hearing now that this person is breathing on his own for a little while, reacting to some activity around him. The officer has not been named. Fraternal Order of Police Union boss John Catanzara telling the Sun-Times he has a glimmer of hope. So...
okay.
Well, hopefully.
It's looking positive, as you said. That's good. And it looks like Governor Pritzker is weighing in on what happened there. He's placing blame for Saturday's hospital attack on a judge. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said.
It's one of the great things about the Safety Act is we give the judges the ability to say, no, you're not going to get bail. You are going to stay in jail. And a judge can make this decision. A judge should have made the decision to keep that person in jail.
What do we know about the suspect, Lisa?
We know that he was on electronic monitoring, but this judge, he had been in court previously. He was answering for arrest warrants against him for committing armed carjacking, armed robbery in December. The judge, John Lake Jr., pushed back that hearing. He allowed this suspect, Alfonso Talley is his name, out on electronic monitoring, and Pritzker called that a mistake.
Mm. Yeah, Governor Pritzker also had some strong words for the U.S. Supreme Court following yesterday's decision that weakens a provision in the Federal Voting Rights Act. Let's take a listen.
Illinois is the proud home to having sent more black congresspeople to Washington than any other state in the country. And the decision that was made today by SCOTUS about the Voting Rights Act is an attack on minorities across this country.
Mitch, what do you make of Governor Pritzker's response there?
This is something that Illinois Democrats kind of saw coming down the pike for the last several months, and Democrats nationwide, too, this gutting of the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the Illinois House last month actually passed a proposal that would essentially propose a constitutional amendment to the state constitution that would codify some of those rights here locally, at least. That effort is actually on pause now in the Senate. The Senate President Don Harmon said, they want more legal experts and input on how to properly address what they say are, you know, really fundamental violations of, voting protections. So it will be interesting to see how exactly they approach that in the months ahead. It's a busy session in Springfield. It's certainly Don Harmon essentially ruled out anything happening by the end of May. So it's going to be a long road here.
Yeah. Sophie, in other news, the leader of some of Chicago's largest arts organizations is throwing their support behind a proposed state bill that targets sellers of fake tickets. What should we know here?
Yeah, so my colleague Courtney Kippers reported on this story earlier this week. A few leaders from Ravinia and Lyric Opera and the Joffrey Ballet all got together to speak on this piece of legislation that moved through the Illinois House and is now at the Senate level. Basically, it would ban resellers from selling tickets that they do not have at the time of listing. So this would prevent things like ghost tickets. So this may have happened to you where you buy a ticket on a resale website like Ticketmaster or StubHub and you show up and the ticket is fake. And this isn't just happening at like big Taylor Swift concerts. This is happening at local venues all over Chicago.
Yeah, no, I am all for this legislation because I may or may not have been a victim of something like this.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
No.
Yeah, Lisa, Mitch, any thoughts on this proposed state bill here targeting those fake ticket sellers?
You know, it's a scourge on folks just trying to enjoy an outing
great
in Chicago.
Word. Yeah. It is a scourge, a scourge. I'm shaking my fist. It's terrible. I don't even like to buy tickets from resellers.
Exactly. Especially because so many
I was desperate,
venues,
Lisa. Don't judge me.
No judging.
I was desperate.
Like so many independent venues are really hurting right now. There was a study released earlier this year that 3 out of 4 independent venues in Chicago are not profitable. And that is hurting these venues, not only monetarily, but like people are showing up and being mad at the venue for not doing anything about it.
Right.
And this gives people a little bit of recourse. They can report it to the attorney general and then they can open up investigations into these resellers as well.
Yeah, that's nice. Mitch, you have been busy. You've been on Sox duty.
That's
so
right.
So far, so good.
That's right, Sasha.
Right?
And don't look now, but these White Sox are actually looking pretty good.
They are looking pretty good.
For the first time in about 3 years or so. And actually, they just wrapped up April at 13-13. So that means as many wins as losses, mm-hmm. which doesn't sound impressive, but the Sox have not accomplished that in almost 3 years.
Wow. Usually sort of topsy-turvy with like a lot more losses than wins.
A lot. Yeah, not terribly topsy-turvy. There's only turvy on the South Side the last couple of years, unfortunately.
Ouch.
But you know, they've got this new slugger, Munetaka Murakami.
Yes.
He's
mm-hmm.
tied for the league lead in home runs. They've got a surprisingly strong starting pitching rotation. So it's kind of looking like this rebuild that they've been going through since 2023. You know, obviously everyone remembers 2024,
mm-hmm.
The worst history in baseball history, 121 losses. It's looking like maybe they're finally turning a corner.
Yeah, after the rebuild, there's always that period that you've got to wait for them to sort of, you know, gel and get things settled. And then so maybe this is the season, 2026, this is the season where we're, you know, it's only up.
There's a lot of big prospects showing up finally. You know, baseball, it's compared to other sports, it takes longer to really overhaul a roster compared to football or basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys that they drafted a few years ago are finally arriving. Noah Schultz, he's an Aurora native, 6'10", left-handed pitcher.
Ooh.
He looks really good so far.
What about Davis Martin?
Davis Martin, he was actually on that all-time losing his team. And he's, you know, he's more of a veteran in the locker room. He's a, you know, 29 years old, but that's pretty old in the White Sox locker room.
Right.
And he's been one of the best pitchers in the American League so far this year, which has been really fun
and
to watch.
And we've got him.
That's right.
Pretty awesome. Back to you, Sophie, because the Chicago Critic Film Festival is kicking off this weekend. What makes this film festival so unique for folks who aren't familiar?
Yeah, well, it is one of the most selective film festivals in the city. It runs through next week. And basically how it works is that different critics from across Chicago go to these other festivals like Sundance or South by Southwest and then bring their favorite films back to Chicago for us to see, which is really special.
Mm.
So, for example, it opens up with a film called The Invite. It stars and is directed by Olivia Wilde, who you might know from Don't Worry, Darling or Booksmart. And so that opened at Sundance and now it's coming here. Olivia
nice.
Wilde will actually be here on Thursday to do a Q&A after the film. Unfortunately, that one is like majorly sold out.
Oh, of course.
But it is really exciting that we get all of these, and every film that is at the Critics Festival is a Chicago debut, so has not been seen at on any screens in Chicago yet.
Yeah. It's also UNESCO International Jazz Day.
Yes.
The celebrations are centered in Chicago this year, which is really exciting. Chicagoan and legendary jazz pianist Herbie Hancock is one of the people behind this. Here's a little bit of what he had to say on Morning Edition.
We've had it at the White House before. We've had it in New Orleans at the very beginning. Now here we are on the 15th anniversary of International Jazz Day, having it in my hometown.
So exciting. We talked earlier this week with Kurt Elling, who is also part of the organization efforts here, also performing. What else should we know, Sophie?
So Herbie and Kurt will both be performing at the Lyric Opera tonight with 40-some-odd other jazz artists. It's going to be a really exciting show of talent.
Yeah.
And it will also be streamed for free online. And there are multiple watch parties happening all around the city. And you can learn more about that on WBEZ.org, where to watch.
That's where Lisa's ears perked up when you said free.
I'm really upset I couldn't get a ticket for tonight.
It was so competitive.
It was super competitive. But, you know, my husband and I, we took a trip to Rockford. We couldn't get a ticket to see Herbie Hancock at Symphony Center over the summer. So we saw him. We drove out to Rockford. He was so great. That man is 84 years old.
Oh, yeah.
And he can move.
Oh, that's amazing.
He sounds amazing. His playing is on point. He's just fantastic. Yeah. So don't miss it.
It's a fun time. All right. Pivoting here, Lisa, tomorrow is May 1st.
Yes.
New work requirements for SNAP participants are going to go into effect then. Remind us, what changes have been made?
All right. So the Trump administration has kind of gutted SNAP. And now they say in order to stay online, you're going to have to work or volunteer 80 hours a month if you want to stay enrolled. And so starting tomorrow, the Illinois Department of Public Health, I think, said that the Department of Human Services, they said that about 120,000 people are at risk of losing their benefits. It's just in Illinois. People are not going to lose it immediately tomorrow, but it's going to be on a rolling basis. So those new requirements coming in, and a lot of people are at risk of losing the food that they depend on.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, we've done a lot of coverage over the last several months, particularly our Sun-Times colleague Elvia Malagon has been following the bouncing ball here with SNAP. And we've talked to, you know, Chicagoans, Illinoisans who have come to rely on this month after month to feed their families. And so it's just the fact that this is just so up in the air, it just continues to upset me.
It's upsetting.
There's no other way to put it.
No.
You know? What other stories are you following, Lisa?
Okay, there's a really interesting gambling story in the Tribune that you should read about. A bunch of people, or I think 22 people, were indicted in this federal FBI raided a couple of restaurants in Indiana. So you can read about that. But also, did you hear about the cow?
Oh, my God.
What cow?
The cow news?
The cow. Okay,
there's a cow down at the U of I, Champaign-Urbana. A large cow was being unloaded out of a trailer, and then the cow got loose and started, you know, wandering around a cemetery.
Oh, no.
But she's okay.
Wait, she was wandering around a cemetery.
She's so emo, right?
Of all places.
I gave her a name.
Okay, what's
Evelyn Champagne King.
Oh.
Thank you. You know, that's just locational. But, you know, after the disco soul queen, right?
Yeah, love that.
But she's okay.
But she's good.
Few scratches.
The cow has been found.
The cow is good. She was caught about 2 hours later.
Oh, boy.
People just sort of followed her around. waiting for her to be caught, but she's good.
What an ordeal that must have been.
Poor Evelyn.
Mitch, are you picturing them trying to capture this?
There was a video going around on social media that looked like, you know, kind of one of those scenes out of Spain with the running of the bulls. I'm assuming that was a fake video.
That AI will get you every time.
Yeah, every time.
All right, the socks are off today, Mitch. So what's next for you? More socks or back to your political coverage?
Back to my day job. Today we'll be out at the Bally Chicago Casino site in River West. They're installing the final support beam of this casino that they've been building for a few years now. Not opening terribly soon, but getting closer.
Okay, we'll keep an eye out for that. What else is the art desk working on? Courtney and Mike over there, busy.
Oh, yeah. So actually, I've been working on a food story. So it was written by WBEZ contributor Maggie Hennessy. Friend of the show. We released a story by her today about a new restaurant called Gilda in Westtown that's opening on Chicago Ave in June. And, you know, it's an independent spot. But the restaurateurs Jeremy Levin and Rafael Esparza are, like, basically independently funding this restaurant and kind of are doing a new investment model where, like, people in the neighborhood or people interested in the restaurant can actually invest in the restaurant and, like, get what they call a compañero card. And it's, like, if you invest $250 in the restaurant, like, up front, you will get 8% back on every order you have out. So it's just a new investment model for, like, independent restaurants operating in Chicago, especially since they got denied from a small business loan and weren't quite sure why. And
listen, opening a new restaurant is not easy.
Exactly.
My hat goes off to folks who, you know, you have your repeats too, right? You have people who have tried and it wasn't successful. They'll try again. And I'm like, wow, you are you are made of something that I'm not made of.
Exactly.
It can be rough.
Yeah, especially with the rising cost of food generally. Yes. Rent is getting more expensive. So it's just like an interesting experimental new way to have a new independent neighborhood spot that's not backed by like a big restaurant group.
Yeah, because when it's, you know, successful, it's really rewarding.
Exactly.
Yeah. WBEZ's Sophie Hernandez-Simeonidis, Lisa Laves, and Mitchell Armantrout with the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yasin, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.